Joe Biden declares victory in the U.S. presidential election, while President Donald Trump says the election is far from over. Iran's president says the next U.S. administration should use the opportunity to make up for past mistakes and return to its international commitments. And the leader of Lebanon's largest Christian political bloc says the U.S. has sanctioned him because he refused to comply with his request to sever ties with Hezbollah. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to the United States this hour, where President-elect Joe Biden has delivered his victory speech among his supporters in the state of Delaware, pledging to heal a divided America.
For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now, let's give each other a chance. It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric, lower the temperature, see each other again, listen to each other again. And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies. They are not our enemies, they are Americans.
Biden promised to make the United States respected around the world again, vowing to tackle climate change and systemic racism in the country. Several U.S. news networks, including Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, declared Biden the 46th U.S. president after he extended his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania. His electoral vote count now stands at 290, surpassing the 270 he needs to enter the White House. Biden supporters poured into the streets in front of the White House in Washington and in several other cities to celebrate the win. Trump, however, has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the result in courts. In a statement, Trump said Biden is rushing falsely to pose as the winner and the election is far from over. Trump's latest lawsuit was filed in Arizona, where he alleges that Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by in-person voters on Election Day. Meanwhile, Trump supporters have come out in some U.S. cities to reject the results of the election.
We go home. Lock him up! Lock him up! Lock him up! Lock him up! We go home.
We go home.
In St. Paul, hundreds gathered outside the Minnesota governor's residence to protest what they believe is a widespread voter fraud in favor of Biden. They demanded the president-elect be put in jail. Protesters in Phoenix, Arizona, dismissed the outcome as fake and unfair. Moving on to Georgia's state capital, Atlanta, a group of armed fans of Trump stood guard in front of the Capitol building. They wore combat gear and carried automatic rifles in show of support for Trump. Like most pro-Trump rallies, many of the protesters were maskless in a country hit hardest by the coronavirus pandemic.
Democratic challenger Joe Biden has declared victory in the U.S. presidential election. The decision came after the Associated Press called the state of Pennsylvania for Biden, despite a lead of around 30,000 votes. Incumbent Donald Trump has refused to concede. The simple fact is, this election is far from over, Trump said in a statement released just minutes after NBC projected Biden to be the winner. Trump vowed that as soon as Monday, his team will start prosecuting our case in court to ensure election laws are fully upheld. He added his observers were not allowed into the counting rooms and said he won the election, getting 71 million legal votes. But Biden supporters celebrated around the country anyway.
I'm out here today to celebrate a victory because
Right now, we need reparations in our community and for our country. And Biden might be the one that get it to us, along with our first woman of color for vice president. And I think this is a huge celebration.
The use of mail-in ballots has already provided months of controversy and made this an election which is counted unlike any other. Many Republican supporters contested their validity and in huge numbers rejected using them. Democrats say fraud has not been proven, but analysts say that seems like something the courts may ultimately be forced to decide when the votes are finally counted. Biden's declaration of victory before all the votes are counted in this very narrow and very divisive election may anger many of Trump's 70 million voters. They may continue to insist that the judicial branch fully vet this very unique election and not drop their hundreds of ongoing lawsuits.
The lawsuits, while very dubious, all he has to do is hit one federal judge that he appointed who punts it to the Supreme Court, and they could overturn Pennsylvania's vote count. It's a very precarious situation.
Trump himself has spread allegations of electoral fraud in key states, despite repeated pushback from election officials and judges in numerous court cases. As vote tallies in crucial states appear to be favoring Biden in the days after Election Day, Trump even demanded that states stop counting ballots. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
America's allies are sending congratulatory messages to U.S. President-elect Joe Biden, signaling they won't back incumbent President Donald Trump's refusal to accept election results. The German chancellor, the French president, and the Canadian prime minister separately congratulated Biden. The trio, who had strained relations with Trump, called for cooperation with the U.S. against what they call great global challenges. The British and Japanese prime ministers also said they look forward to working with Biden's government. The British premier specifically named climate change a thorny issue Trump dismissed as a hoax. However, Mexico's president, who has a good personal relation with Trump, said it is too soon to congratulate Biden. Andres Manuel Lopez said he would wait for the resolution of what he called all legal issues in the U.S. election. Now, journalist and political analyst Max Perry says U.S. President Donald Trump is unlikely to be able to produce enough evidence showing irregularities in the presidential election.
I just have a hard time imagining that the Trump camp is going to be able to provide sufficient burden of proof of wrongdoing in this raft of lawsuits enough to change the outcome in any of these contested battleground states. Most of the legal experts are indicating that, you know, his efforts are unlikely to succeed. A lot of Trump's foreign policy has diplomatically isolated the U.S. I certainly don't have to tell your network that. I mean, the Iran deal was pulling out of the Iran deal was very unpopular. Trump has made several other brash moves. I think that there's an indication that they see, like the U.S. political establishment, they see Trump as an insufficient manager of empire, and that a Biden victory means a return to having a more efficient steward at the head of U.S. imperialism.
Author and columnist Ed Nartanjan says Joe Biden is a seasoned politician who will face challenges in solving problems left behind by Donald Trump.
The question is, what is his grand vision? Right now, it's very easy in terms of contrast to Donald Trump. I mean, Biden is a gentleman. No one accuses him of being a four-flushing con man who lies all the time. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he has it easy in that respect. But he's going to have to move the United States out of its current trajectory. Economically, he has to do something about COVID-19. In terms of being a politician, seasoned, one of the youngest senators there ever was, now the oldest president there ever was. He really does understand how to go into a room and just say, listen, what is it going to take to get your vote? That means that he's willing to, you know, trade back, do a little old pork barreling politics in order to get what he thinks he needs. Mm-hmm. And then that's probably better than Obama. Obama might have had soaring rhetoric and things like this, but he had difficulty sitting down and just kind of making deals, especially with people he didn't particularly like, to get things done. So in that terms, yes, very able in terms of the details. The question is, what is the grand vision for the United States, other than just pursuing kind of American exceptionalism, this idea that the U.S. should maintain its hegemony?
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the next U.S. administration should seize the opportunity to make up for Washington's past mistakes. Rouhani said the U.S. now has the chance to live up to its international commitments by respecting global regulations. He touched upon the Iranian nation's resistance to the economic war launched by the White House, saying the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic is doomed to fail. The Iranian president reiterated that his country has always made good on its obligations and adopted the strategy for constructive interactions with the world. He added it's time to promote regional security and development through cooperation with neighboring countries. University Professor Mohammed Marandi says the next U.S. administration must fully implement Iran's nuclear deal as the first step to rectify Washington's mistakes towards Tehran.
Well, we have to keep in mind that it was Obama who actually initiated this maximum pressure campaign in the first place. The sanctions that the Iranians are being imposed upon the Iranian people by Trump were first imposed upon Iran by Obama, and Biden was his vice president. Iran doesn't have any expectations, but if the United States under Biden wants to move forward, the only way forward is the full implementation of the nuclear deal. And we have to remember that under Obama and Biden, of course, the United States never fully implemented the nuclear deal. Never. At any point. For example, I as an individual, or you as an individual, you could never use the banking system before Trump even to send a dollar abroad or to bring a dollar into the country. Mm-hmm. So the United States, or any other currency, so the United States blocked the implementation of the nuclear deal under Obama.
The leader of Lebanon's largest Christian political bloc has blasted U.S. sanctions against him as politically motivated. Gebran Bassi dismissed the U.S.'s allegation of corruption, saying he was sanctioned after rejecting the U.S.'s demand for ending his party's support for the Hezbollah resistance movement. The former foreign minister said abandoning Hezbollah would have caused internal strife in Lebanon, stressing that he was targeted because he sought to protect his country. Washington deems Hezbollah a terrorist group and has been trying to block it out of Lebanon's politics. Hezbollah has condemned U.S. attempts as well as blacklisting of Basil as blatant and gross interference in Lebanon's internal affairs. Well, senior Air Force commanders in the U.S. have said the country must be prepared for conflict with China in the Pacific Rim. The two sides have already been at odds over developments in the region for months now, while having tension on other issues, including trade.
Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump made it no secret that he was on the warpath when it came to China. Not only did he spark a contentious trade war with the Chinese, but he also brazenly stated that the COVID-19 virus was Chinese-made, sparking notions of racism, which, along with his disastrous handling of the virus in the U.S., likely cost him his place at the White House. It's therefore strange to see a senior U.S. Air Force commander stating that U.S. troops in the region should prepare for conflict in the near future, echoing tones stated by Chinese President Xi Jinping during a recent visit to a military barracks in China. In spite of the ongoing election saga taking place in the US, the Americans claim that the Chinese are taking part in malicious activities around the Pacific Rim, and in particular in the South China Sea, stating that China is misaligned with international law. Yet it can be argued that the polar opposite is true, as the US seek to provoke and agitate the Chinese by sending senior representatives to Taiwan, as well as stoking the flames in the recent tensions in Hong Kong, suggesting that if anyone should be claiming foul play, it's the Chinese over the Americans. It therefore remains to be asked as to whether the Americans are more eager to start a conflict than China. With the US already embroiled in a host of conflicts around the world, could the US then be seeking to start another with its greatest rival China, not only to cement its place as a world power, but also to stem the rise of the Chinese emerging as a threat to the US hegemony?
I can say that for sure this kind of provocative statement, they come from the United States. They don't come from China. From China there is no statement or will to provoke a war, basically.
Well, the U.S. may have a very hard time ahead when it comes to facing China militarily in the South China Sea. Maybe that's why the administration of President Donald Trump has set up alliances with other countries in the region, including India, Japan, and Australia. Trump, however, has failed to draw the full support of those regional countries in his anti-China stance. Now, at home, support for Trump seems to be fading fast also, as he is unwilling to leave the presidency. Trump's close advisors and secretaries are distancing themselves from a man who has refused to concede defeat in Tuesday's presidential election. Now, this may impact the U.S.'s war path towards China, including its allies' participation in confronting Beijing militarily.
When Donald Trump paid a visit to India, many claim that the partnership formed between Modi and Trump was aimed at sending a message to another regional player, namely China, and it seems that the predictions were correct. The US has also expanded its regional and global sphere of influence further, as it seems that both Germany and Australia have joined the Americans and Indians in the region by performing military exercises in the area, clearly adding another US-backed layer of provocation towards China.
There are many countries involved, but from my point of view, I will say just the countries that are, for sure in the alliance with the United States. I will mention Japan, South Korea, definitely Vietnam, India, and Australia.
Yet with the election of President-elect Joe Biden to the White House, we may see the U.S. reverse its rhetoric towards China as Biden attempts to pick up the pieces left behind from the Trump legacy. However, there's one very worrying factor in the equation, namely that Trump still has until the end of January before handing over power to Biden, meaning that the unstable president may still have a trick or two up his sleeve, including the temptation of testing the very massive military that he leads. But as Trump finds himself on the way out, many of those surrounding him have also distanced themselves from the outgoing president, including a vital piece of the conflict puzzle, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who has prepared his resignation letter for Trump. But for now, it's probably safe to say that all attention has been diverted away from a conflict between the US and China as the Americans enter a transition period, and Biden waits with anticipation to tell Trump, "You're fired."
And now to Iran, which has reported its highest daily fatalities from COVID-19 since the disease broke out in mid-February. Health Ministry spokeswoman Seema Saadat-Lahri said nearly 460 people lost their lives to the virus during the past 24 hours. That takes Iran's total deaths to more than 38,000. She added infections increased by over 9,200. The figure brings the country's total confirmed cases to more than 682,000. The Iranian government has put new restrictions across the country to curb the spread of the virus. Authorities have warned that daily tallies will further spike if people fail to observe health protocols. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In a display of traditional Eurocentric hypocrisy, whenever hostile elements within Europe find a need to justify their aggressive behavior towards Muslims who are either citizens or refugees, leaders such as Macron invoke false narratives. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Iqbal Jarset, writer. This article is published under the heading, Macron's defiant support for Charlie Hebdo is tantamount to a declaration of war on Islam. Here's the details of this article. Misreading, and deliberately so, the causes for the fury across the Muslim world and remaining defiant in insulting Islam, French President Emmanuel Macron has vowed to fight to the death. The implications are clear. It's a declaration of war against Muslims and Islam. Those spun in a deceptive language known under the rubric of culture and talk, words such as jihadism or Muslim fundamentalism, amongst others, Macron, along with hardcore right-wing Islamophobes, sought to depict their terroristic stance as a defense of secularism. In a display of traditional Eurocentric hypocrisy, whenever hostile elements within Europe find a need to justify their aggressive behavior towards Muslims who are either citizens or refugees, leaders such as Macron invoke false narratives. Popular one, which is not too different from the Zionist regime version and which forms part of Trump's fabrication too, is that they falsely claim Muslims hate us because they despise freedom. In the Macron version, we are often reminded by French officials that France is targeted because of its reputation as the cradle of human rights and a rampant of global democracy. But this isn't. It is against this backdrop that he has willfully downplayed the fact that global Muslim anger stems from the insistence by Charlie Hebdo to provoke, insult, and defy Muslims by republishing sacrilegious caricatures of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Notwithstanding the outrage caused when the blasphemous cartoons were originally published during 2005 in Denmark, that Macron chose to defend and support republication speaks to his intent to fuel flames of hate. Ill will towards French Muslims, both indigenous and migrants from former colonies in Africa and the Arabian Peninsula, where France once held sway as a colonial master, is a recipe for disaster. And to extend the ill will to the rest of the Muslim Ummah across the entire world by subjecting the honor and dignity of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, to that of a cartoon character is intolerable. Far from being an expression of free speech, such abominable conduct is a disingenuous abuse of freedoms to cause hurt. Hate-filled venom to attack and assault religious beliefs cannot be condoned. To continue doing so under the guise of secularism reflects either insecurity or vulnerability, or indeed both. The recent blasphemous act suggests too that Macron is incapable of reconciling his personal prejudice against Islam with the demands of his presidency to allow the peaceful coexistence of all faith-based communities under a neutral state. This is evidenced by the direct interference of the state in imposing limitations on Muslims' ability to exercise free choices. It is the height of irony that in proclaiming the right to freedom of expression, for the right-wing elements to hurl abuse via caricatures, Muslim females are banned from expressing their freedom of belief. A 2004 law makes it a criminal offense to don headscarves, while a 2011 law disallows face veils. These draconian laws are to be followed through with new laws Macron plans to introduce to crack down on Islamist fundamentalists, as he claims. We have thus far seen his government silencing Muslims critical of his crusader mentality by expelling them. We know too that mosques have been raided and a number of Muslim NGOs shut down. The belligerent language used by Macron in describing the aims of the planned new law has raised fears of the further alienation of French Muslims. That his speech is littered with threats such as France should diminish Islamists, and having the audacity to publicly vow that his government won't renounce the caricatures is no less than a declaration of war. Macron have thus escalated America's so-called war on terror to France's war on Islam.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Aperture.
Witness how, cloaked in the shadows to the light of public scrutiny, the Bilderberg Group began to form their own self-serving agendas and wielded their immense power and resources to redesign the world in their vision. Yet, today, this old institution faces a new climate thanks to a new wave of savvy investigative journalists who attempt to peel away the secret history and ongoing influence of this organization. Don't go away. Here's the next part.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has been deeply involved in the Bilderberg Group, attending dozens of their meetings over the years and acting on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. Kissinger faces allegations of war crimes for his involvement in the secret bombing campaign that took place in Cambodia during the Vietnam War in the 1970s. It is alleged that Kissinger willfully engaged in the murder of tens of thousands of civilians in various areas of Cambodia, which led to the destabilization of the country into a civil war, resulting in the rise of the infamous Khmer Rouge. Kissinger is also wanted in several countries for his involvement in supporting the Pinochet regime and the CIA-backed coup that took place in Chile on September 11, 1973. Pinochet, who is now facing a war crimes tribunal, murdered the democratically elected President Salvador Allende and started a military junta, which resulted in the kidnapping, forced displacement, and torture of thousands of men, women, and children in Chile. Henry Kissinger actively supported these actions that were taking place at that time, which constituted crimes against humanity. Kissinger was also involved in a controversial study in 1974 called National Security Study Memorandum 200, in which the basic thesis called for an active campaign for the depopulation of several less developed countries to stem the risk for civil unrest.
Are you still giving out orders like Memorandum 200, where you said depopulation should be hell? Sir, just a question. I'm not going to go to hell, because Memorandum 200, sir? Memorandum 200. Just ask him a question about Memorandum 200 that he wrote in April 24, 1974. It's an honest question. Kissinger, Memorandum 200. Depopulation.
We're on topic now. We came here, we give you the access. You want to burn bridges, you can do that.
I don't want to burn any bridges. I didn't. I wasn't disrespectful. I wasn't accusatory. It was a serious question.
We're on topic.
Okay, I understand that. So what about the depopulation? I mean, Memorandum 200. Why are you afraid to talk about your depopulation plan?
Why don't you get lost?
Why should I get lost? It's serious.
You're a sick person.
How am I sick? You're the one committing.
I hope it's the beginning of a whole new epoch of greater and greater coverage. At the same time, we're in danger because of their designs on the internet. This could also be the high watermark. It really depends on who stands their ground and what the fight will be. Because, of course, we've just broke last week, people from the European Commission, the Dutch woman Neelie Kroes, wants a mandatory internet ID for Europe. Cybercom was launched only 2 years ago. We saw the Stuxnet virus admittedly engineered from the U.S. and Israeli and other related allies to use against Iran and so forth. On that pretext, they want to take greater and greater control of the web. The United Nations also trying to have a reach over the web.
The Bilderberg Group include many prominent members of the internet and computing world, including National Security Agency Director and Chief of the United States Cyber Command, co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, and many others.
More and more, we're seeing the Iron Curtain of media censorship on Bilderberg and the shadow government, shadow elite, pull back. So we're seeing Bilderberg basically try to pass the baton off to younger people right now, a bunch of tech folks, Google, Facebook, and others, hoping that the police state tech grid can protect their criminal activity. They're trying to push a global bank as the solution to all our problems that they created. They're openly trying to push more police state systems. They want to end internet freedom. They want to bring in internet IDs.
The mainstream media is no longer mainstream. The alternative is taking over, and they're trying their damnedest to either restrict or shut down the free internet as we know it right now.
The increase of internet-based media has been closely correlated with the decrease of traditional forms of media, such as newspapers and television, which have been monopolized by members of the Bilderberg Group. In their efforts to maintain the control of information globally, influential figures of the media have been routinely invited to participate in the conferences over the years. Peter Mansbridge of CBC's The National attended the meeting in 2010 and has maintained their strict rules for secrecy ever since. Fellow Canadian Heather Reisman is the CEO of Indigo Books, the largest book supplier in Canada, and she is a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee. In 2005, Reisman founded the Hesseg Foundation, which provides grants to former lone soldiers in the Israeli Army to pursue post-secondary education. A lone soldier is an individual who is not from Israel, but chooses to fight in the Israeli military. Other media moguls and organizations that have attended the Bilderberg meetings over the years have included Rupert Murdoch of News Corporation, Andrew Knight of News Corporation and The Economist, Ted Turner of Time Warner and CNN, Charlie Rose, Donald Graham of The Washington Post, and Canadian media baron and former Bilderberg Steering Committee member Conrad Black of Hollinger International and the Telegraph newspaper. While all of these powerful media organizations have been present at Bilderberg meetings over the years, there has remained a media blackout all across the board regarding coverage of this group.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering what your opinions were. You talk a little bit about it in the book of the influence of the Bilderberg Group on the mainstream media, or on just the influence.
The individuals are influential, but their influence isn't magnified by Bilderberg. I went for 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's just a talking shop, and they're almost always wrong, by the way. They didn't see the end of the Cold War coming. They didn't see the economic crisis coming. They're very interesting meetings. They're very interesting people, but they're not coherent. They aren't a group that meets other than for 3 days a year, and the composition of them changes all the time, except for about 30 of us who are on the steering committee.
And how come?
Don't buy into these conspiracy theories. It's rubbish. All they do is talk to each other. I was on that conference circuit for 20 years, the Trilateral Commission, and I went to all of them. And Yeah, look, it was fine while it lasted, but I'm getting too old for that. I'm getting tired. But,
okay.
You know.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Right.
But there's no conspiracy in any of them.
No?
Yeah. No, there's a bunch of people.
How come you never hear about it in the media? Like, I only read about it in your book.
They don't allow the media.
No.
But in order to encourage people to talk frankly, which you do, you get good, frank sessions, but there's no meeting of the minds.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Fellow Hollinger International Board of Directors member Marie-Josée Kravis has made significant inroads since being invited to Bilderberg by Conrad Black in 1989. Marie-Josée is the wife of Bilderberg member Henry Kravis and has been a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee for over 22 years. At the trial of the now-defunct media baron Conrad Black, Marie-Josée Kravis testified against him, providing evidence for the prosecution. Other prominent Canadians who have attended the Bilderberg conferences include former Prime Minister of Canada Lester B. Pearson, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, and Stephen Harper. Many other influential Canadian politicians and business leaders have also attended the secret meetings, including former NDP leader Bob Rae, former Liberal Party leaders Stéphane Dion and Michael Ignatieff, former Premier of Ontario Mike Harris, former Premier of New Brunswick Bernard Lord, former Premier of British Columbia Gordon Campbell, the Premier of Alberta Alison Redford, the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper Nigel S. Wright, and Power Corporation of Canada CEO Paul Desmarais Sr. In fact, nearly every Canadian Prime Minister back to Pierre Elliott Trudeau has worked for Power Corp.
In 1996, you were at the Bilderberg meeting, and also there was Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin.
I don't know if I was at that meeting. I've only been to a few of them, but I Bilderberg and Trilateral are not really think tanks. They're simply individuals who get together who are from business, the political world, the media, others, and discuss ideas, and they influence each other through that.
Shortly after Dan and Steve got back from the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, I decided to file some Access to Information Act requests for information on both Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, and for Nigel S. Wright, who is the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I received two notices. One was for Nigel S. Wright, and it actually revealed very little. They just said that they didn't have any record of him having attended the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, even though he was on the official attendees list. In 2011, the Harper government decided to amend the Access to Information Act and privacy request forms, making it so that anybody that was on the Prime Minister's cabinet was exempt from releasing any personal information. In the case of Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, I did receive actually quite a big disclosure from their Executive Council office in Alberta. 31 pages were disclosed to me just the other day. All sorts of different pages have notices to destroy these emails, do not release this information to the public, do not release any information about your travel itinerary prior to attending the meeting. But a lot of the stuff is redacted. A lot of this information is redacted out. That's cited under different sections of the Privacy Protection Act, which is goes hand in hand with the Access to Information Act request. So any other information that was in there about other people has been redacted out. There's also a page in here that describes the nature of the meetings. Off the record, fruitful discussions are enhanced by an atmosphere of mutual trust in which participants can express themselves freely. All discussions are therefore private and off the record. The press is excluded from the meetings. A list of participants will be released to the press on the eve of the conference. There's nothing to hide. If you're doing good things, you don't have anything to hide. There's only something to hide if you don't want people hearing what you're saying. That's the only reason to say it off the record, is that you wouldn't want to be quoted on something that could be damaging to your career.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
How do you feel about secrecy in government?
It's a scary thing. I mean, it's secret, so I don't really know much about it.
I can understand if the secrecy is for national security, but, you know, secrecy and covering up, you know, financial documents and things like that, I think as taxpayers, you know, we have the right to know what's going on in our government.
I think secrecy is pretty inherent in the Canadian government, for sure, and in all governments. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish government was completely democratic, which would mean that we would be a part of it. But seeing as, like, we have representatives in this House deciding on issues for us, secrecy kind of just comes with that.
I honestly don't think it's a good idea for anybody to be secret. I don't think anything should be secret. I think if anything needs to be said, it needs to be said in front of the people here that can hear it.
We elect people to govern us in a democratic way. And when those people fall, you know, prey to, you know, individuals that have money or, you know, have leverage on them, it's no different than a dictatorship. When you have, like, government officials and then you have financiers and, like, heads of, like, banks meeting behind closed doors, that's already against the law.
We have really no idea. And without you guys, we wouldn't be around to know, so.
The more independent media that covers events like this or like anything gives a more unbiased opinion, considering how slanted our current media is.
It doesn't have to be a, you know, massive media tycoon that's controlling what's being said anymore. You know, the average person can do it, right? Which is, I mean, you know, that's an amazing feat. We didn't have that 50 years ago. We didn't have that at all.
It's time to get it out there. We should at least know.
Almost everybody here has a camera. They're all doing live streaming. They're all, you know, interviewing people. I mean, there is just everywhere from, you know, really big names with big websites to just people doing their own little thing. And it's crazy. I mean, everybody has a camera this year.
We live in the time of intelligence, of technology, of instant information. And more these people are realizing that, and they're going to realize that today with the hundreds of people that are surrounding the Marriott Hotel where Bilderberg 2012 is being held.
What do you think about, you know, the independent media's these days' ability to use social media and live streaming at these kinds of events?
It's amazing, and it shows you how many people that are getting aware and politically aware to this.
Isn't everyone's becoming the independent media because of the double-edged sword that is social media? It's also, of course, a spy tool, as everyone knows.
They're worried about us. They're worried about you. They're worried about every person out here with a cell phone that's able to broadcast live or put the video online, where in the decades past it would require an entire news crew and an assignment, tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Now we can do it standing out here with a cell phone. So their technology that they're using to bug us, their Orwellian nightmare, Big Brother or surveillance systems, we're just turning it against them and showing them that we're watching.
What we're seeing here in 2012 represents not just an evolution of social media, of independent media, of the ability of citizen journalists to bring attention to causes that and events that the mainstream media will refuse to cover.
You had thousands and thousands of people watching live stream video, you know. They're interested. People are dying for real information, truth.
We are able to pretty much broadcast to the world, to thousands of people, live, unedited, uncut, as everything's happening, pretty much just through a cell phone. It's, you know, we're living in amazing times. The technology is advancing.
It's like more than it's a protest, it's almost an independent media summit. You know, there are at least 20 cameras here live streaming, not all like with some central hub, no. 20 independent media outlets, 20 individuals doing separate live streams.
We are making a difference. We are forcing the mainstream media to cover these events, you know, and they are coming kicking and screaming, but they are coming.
If you had an opportunity to maybe say a short little message to the people in that room, the people sitting around that table, what might you say to them?
That's a hard question.
It's a tough one, I know. It's a tough one. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It is.
Second. But if I could say anything to the Bilderbergers is, when you do things in darkness, they will come to the light. And they are. We're here just to shine that light. I don't hate you. I'm not going to spend my energy just to negatively go after you. but I will expose you, and I will talk to you, and I will communicate with you with words to try to make you and the world understand that there's a lot more going on than we actually know, and we deserve to know what's happening. We're human beings. We're just as equal as you, and we're all in this world together.
My message to the globalist is the sleeping giant that is humanity is awakening. It's 1776 against their 1984 worldwide. Their system of 1984 against the spirit of liberty. And they will be defeated. And they know it. And they're starting to run scared. And they should be. Because information is power. And the truth is setting us free.
We know who you are, and we're taking our fate back.
We know who you are, and we're going to expose you. All the way. So we're not stopping. We're going to be growing in numbers 100 times this in the future. So just wait. Just wait. We're coming.
I'm sure you guys realize, you know, that this is the fate of the planet. You guys are in control one way or another. People are finding out what's going on.
Life is short. We should live it to the fullest and treat people with respect, honesty, dignity, and compassion. And you could change your life in any moment, any time, and just think about the decisions you're making and how they affect people and how they hurt people, and understand there's real consequences for those decisions that you guys have made, that you guys will have to live with for an eternity, pretty much.
When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan said, if you bow down and worship me, I will give you the world. Well, guess what? You've got the world, and we're not going to bow down and worship you. Those filthy deeds that you have done in secret are now being shouted from the housetops. We are on to you.
The reach of the Bilderberg Group extends to every level of the policy apparatus in both the private and public sectors. Its members over the years have been the most influential and powerful individuals in the world. Whether or not they act in concert with each other or simply influence one another through these meetings is beside the point. The decisions made by each of these individuals have a ripple effect for the rest of the world. For every action, there is an equal but opposite reaction. The creation of this new Orwellian technotronic society has spawned a new generation of warrior, information warriors, whose weapons are the very technologies created to enslave them. As the old forms of media slowly die away, this generation is finding new and exciting ways to spread information, open dialogue, and become the true citizen media. The Bilderberg Group and the individuals that attend are now facing a revolutionary adversary, an informed citizenry armed with the right questions and looking for the true answers.
Well, in shining a much-needed light upon these unprecedented levels of secrecy and powerful world players, this new age of citizen media bravely contends that the Bilderberg Group's lobbying powers represent nothing less than a threat to the democratic process. Well, that's it, everyone, for this week. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.